Marjorie had no choice but to become the mistress of a vengeful warlord. Unless she can either escape or count on rescue, she believes her life is forfeit. But soon she finds she has an unexpected ally and lover in the man ordered to keep watch over her. I'm Heather Songster, and this is Hopelessly Romantic. Welcome back, readers and romance seekers, to another episode. We take one more dive into a historical romance with Her Honorable Mercenary by Nicole Locke from Harlequin's historical imprint. Most of the historical romances that we've read, they've more or less stuck between the Regency and Victorian eras of England, with the one exception of the Roaring Twenties and a blues singer to redeem him. Today, we are looking back much, much further. Her Honorable Mercenary takes place in France in 1297. Our story comes to us from Locke's Lovers and Legends series, and an interesting author's note at the very front tells us that this book technically wasn't on the roster to be written. I have some concern that since we're joining a long-running series that there may be moments of, wait, what's going on? But we'll have to see how it goes. But we won't linger on what-ifs. It's time to get right into it, so let's take a gander at that cover. And it's about what I would expect from Harlequin, meaning it's not great. Our cover features only the proposed hero in this equation, blonde hair cropped short, looking out at us with a stern, brooding expression. I believe I've heard it described as a smolder. As for what men look like in 13th century France, this guy misses almost every single mark. The hair is wrong, the clothes are wrong, everything. Again, I'm not a fashion historian, but I know enough to be able to confidently say that my friends in the Society of Creative Anachronism are screaming. But what else should we expect from Harlequin? They continue to disappoint with their lack of effort in delivering decent covers. If I'm being honest, this cover isn't the worst. It's actually quite nice from a composition standpoint. At least it doesn't look like it was a Photoshop monstrosity like some others I could mention. I can't seem to have it both ways, can I? Either it has a solid composition but fails in content, or the content is correct but the composition is trash. Like, come on, Harlequin, just once, could you at least try? I will say that I'm not going to go after the book itself for historical accuracy, mostly because I don't know a single thing about 13th century France. My time at Renaissance festivals has not qualified me for that knowledge. The only thing that I know is that everybody had beef with everybody. And it's beef that has landed our heroine into the mess that she's currently in. Marjorie of Lyon has been captured, or perhaps it's bartered or sold. The specifics aren't exactly clear yet. Ian of Warstone, a well-known and bloodthirsty warlord, has taken dear Marjorie to be his mistress. Her only crime was to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. She had witnessed Ian threatening someone, and Ian decided that her life now belonged to him. Before we get worked up on this point, Ian is not our intended hero. We are not about to witness a misunderstood brute charm his way into the heart of the woman that he's claimed. Thank the gods for that. Marjorie has had a typical life for a woman in medieval Europe, as in she's been a form of property, pretty much. First, she sold herself to a man named Joss to be his mistress so that she could earn money for her family. Then, when Joss lost her to a gambling match, she was sold to a man named Raoul. In Raoul's home, she knew that she wasn't in the best of situations. He was exceedingly cruel, so she avoided him and his horrible friends as much as possible. Until, that is, she accidentally stumbled upon Ian doing crime, and thus here she was. As they traveled towards Ian's fortress, Marjorie wondered why Ian simply hadn't killed her, but at the back of the mind, she knew, she's always known, why she's always attracted unwanted attention. She knew it had nothing to do with her soul or her demeanor, which at that tender age had consisted of eating, sleeping, and relieving herself in linens, but everything to do with the lavender color of her eyes, the flaxen color of her hair, and perhaps the berry color of her lips, or whatever fanciful color she'd been described as having upon her birth. It had nothing to do with what she had done, only what had been given to her, and it was something within the very marrow of her bones she didn't want. It had caused her nothing but grievances for her and her family. Either brought upon by her looks or her fortunes, Marjorie's future doesn't look great. Ian is one of those sorts who would stab you as soon as look at you, and the moment you cease to be interesting or useful to him, he will dispose of you just as simply as he would if you were flushing the toilet. Not that they had flushing toilets at the time, but you get my meaning. But the name of the game is to please Ian, which might be hard to do for someone who has no idea what that means. She has a sliver of hope, however. While escape doesn't seem likely for Marjorie at the current moment, she's managed to send off two letters before Ian dragged her away. One letter was to her sister, telling her that Marjorie was having a lovely time with a wonderful gentleman, so don't worry about her. The other was to her brother, saying essentially, "Oh God, please save me from this madman." A good example of Ian's madness is displayed when the horse Marjorie is riding freezes up right outside the gate to Ian's fortress. He's angry, thinking that she's showing him disrespect by refusing to enter, but begins to laugh when she's finally able to explain what's really happening. The man has some serious mood shifts, and it's clear that any perceived slight would be enough to warrant her execution. The perspective shifts to the true hero of this novel, Everard. He's cleaning up before Ian's arrival, telling us that appearances were everything to the warlord, and we get some information on his background. Everard seems to be an all-around decent guy, loves his family, has a strong work ethic, so what's he doing with this madman? Why, it's because Ian had threatened the lives of his mother and his sister, of course. So it's a no-win situation for Everard, and he's got no choice but to do as Ian demands. When he arrives to greet Ian at the gates, he's nearly knocked off his feet when he gets sight of Marjorie. He knows that it's not Ian's wife, who was rumored to run off with their two children. She looks like an innocent, okay? But if she's with Ian, could she truly be uncorrupted? The more he looks, the mysteries deepen. Ian was speaking now, introducing her as his mistress, Marjorie. In 10 years, Ian had had no woman, no mistress, and never had he lain with his own servants. Another intrigue, then, and brought to his home. She must be a powerful ally, but Everard didn't recognize her name. Her clothing was fine, so it was possible she was from a noble family, but he'd never seen her before at any residence or castle. However, it appeared everyone around him knew something of her that he didn't. Then he knew it was wrong. It was the crowd. They seemed rapt with attention. I let you all in on the secret a little early. Everard is colorblind, so he can't see the flaxen hair or the lavender eyes or the berry lips. All he sees is a woman and the mystery around her. He's so wrapped in it that he doesn't notice Ian introduced him to Marjorie as the one who would guard her while she was there. Now Marjorie doesn't see potential romance in the tall, silent man to keep watch over her. She sees her already slim chances of escape dwindle to almost nothing as she watches this giant, silent man approach. It's an oppressive silence, too, as he points her along corridors and through doors to Ian's quarters, where she will be staying. I'd be safe in saying that if I were in Marjorie's position, I'd be panicking. But she puts on a brave face, even laughing when Everard continues to impersonate a stone wall. Inside, Everard doesn't know what to do with himself. After leading Marjorie to Ian's quarters, he goes to see Ian, and we can see that he's completely confused with the situation, even more so by his reaction to her. If I'm perfectly honest here, there's something about the way the narration is written that makes my eyes slide over the words, and unfortunately, that's not a good thing. I'll read a passage, and then something will be referenced that I don't remember, so I have to go back and figure it out what it was that I missed. The entire book is like this. When Everard describes his reaction to Marjorie, I think to myself, what reaction? You're a stone wall. It might also be that my mind is already checked out on a lot of the plot points. I mentioned that this was another installment in a long-running series, so I know that there's going to be some information that I'm not going to understand. So my reading brain decides that it doesn't need to retain everything that I've read. This, as you can imagine, makes my life difficult, and it's hard turning this part of my brain off. From Everard's conversation with Ian, which is mostly Everard listening while Ian exposits information, we learn about the Jewel of Kings, a legendary gem hidden in the hollow hilt of a dagger. A little like Excalibur, it's said that whoever holds this jewel holds power in Scotland, and Ian of Warstone wanted it. I think this is the big bit that everything and everyone is focused on. Ian's been losing his damn mind over this last decade, literally, and he's ready to do whatever it takes to get this gem. I think that he was after some information about it when poor Marjorie ran into him while trying to get some food, but again, my eyes are sliding over the plot points, so I really can't be sure. It also appears that Ian is against most of his family in his quest for power, and I gather that none of them are very pleasant either. For now, it's clear that Ian treats the people in his life like toys, and Marjorie was just a new thing to play with. 5 days in, and Marjorie doesn't have much more hope of escaping. She knows that prolonged confinement is not conducive to a healthy mind, and her only distractions have been talking with the maidservant who brings her meals and watching Everard train Ian's men out on the lawn. The maidservant, Jean, had developed a sort of rapport with Marjorie, the conversations being one of the few things that keep her sane. After some banter, Jean playfully asks Marjorie if she'll ask her for assistance with escaping today. Marjorie says no, but she may want something else from the kitchens, her motive being that she'll get more time to talk to Jean. But Jean is rather clever. She leaves a door open on her way out, away from the guard that guided her to Marjorie's door. Our heroine knows a chance when she spots it and flees the room. Her bad luck, however, when Everard catches her in the corridors. He's still at a loss as to why he gravitates toward her. While his first duty is to see Ian's will carried out, Everard is also committed to making sure Marjorie comes to no harm. He doesn't trust the new men that he's been training not to hurt her, and Ian's enemies may use her as leverage if they believe he truly cares about her. He doesn't, but that's beside the point. Everard escorts her back to her room, and on the way, Marjorie gets under his skin in a way that no one else can. Everard knows that she's endangering them both and their families with her antics, but he's become attached to her in a way. He wants to protect her, from Ian, from ill-intended men, from anything that would do her harm. It's not a good situation for him. A few days later, Marjorie pushes the boundaries again. She manages to make her way to the dining hall, and it's not long before Everard finds her there. As he has been wrestling with himself when it comes to Marjorie, Marjorie is also becoming quite intrigued by her near-silent warden. Unlike when she had first arrived, his gaze lingered now. Stares from men she was used to, but Everard's were different. He looked at her as if she was something unusually intriguing, and he never stared at her hair or her eyes. No, when she caught him, he was usually staring at her wide hips. She could almost swear his neck would flush, but couldn't be sure. However, just thinking it so set her imagination off in ways that she hadn't expected. Marjorie was no stranger to men's desires. Having been mistress to two other men already, she knew what was up when she fell under the dreaded male gaze, but she sensed something different from Everard, something that made her feel safe, something that set the wheels turning, imagining what it'd be like that should they go to bed together, something like a spark of something, perhaps. I like seeing the women lusting after the men for once, though. It's certainly much better than the chaste virgin who's got no clue what desire is like. We women can just be as horny as the guys, no matter what century we're living in. They strike up a conversation, as normal a conversation that they can under the circumstances, and here the book throws me for a loop with another dreaded perspective change with no visual effect denoting the change. I'm starting to wonder if this is a stylization choice around books with British authors. Penniless and Pregnant in Paradise did something similar, also a British author. As we've come to know, perspective changes are par for the course in romance novels, but give me a page break or something, anything. It's frustrating for me to be in one character's head and then unexpectedly have to get with the program on another. And as we are having a tableside conversation, inevitably, we need to work in a food metaphor. Everard set down the empty cup, but didn't take the final bite of the roll. His ravenous body was suddenly not interested in food. It was wanting something different, something also at this table, but not for his consumption. So tiny, but not delicate. He wanted to devour her. On the one hand, my inner author slash romance reader gets it. It's a metaphor meant to emphasize how much the hero wants the heroine, proving that his desire for her overrides all other survival instincts. On the other, however, my inner feminist is screeching about how women are not things meant to be consumed. As they talk, Marjorie manages to hit on some sore points for Everard. She's taking a lot of risks, and he is reminded that his own family is at risk, so he shuts down emotionally. Everard warns her not to go around as she pleases, that he'll accompany her on any walk that she wants to take, and to please stop putting herself and Jean at risk with her games. He doesn't realize that he's given his own motivations away, and Marjorie tells him that now she knows that his family is in danger as much as hers is. Everard decides that since it's likely safer for her to take walks with an escort than numerous escape attempts, he offers to take her on the walks over the grounds, as promised. So true to his word, he shows up at her door, offering her walks wherever she might please, within reason, of course. She wasn't allowed to seek out people, like Jean, and certainly was never afforded an opportunity to escape, but she used the time to observe the fortress, hoping that her observations might one day prove useful. This walk helps reveal a few things about Marjorie, namely about her self-worth and self-preservation. She's concerned that Everard is putting himself in danger with these walks, with Ian being as crazy as he is, and when Everard says that it's Ian's right to punish him as the employer, Marjorie won't hear of it. Her whole life has been punctuated by her lack of autonomy, how she's been stolen or traded, even as a baby, because of her looks. She knew that, while she might have had little power over what happened to her, she was allowed to defend herself however she needed. Everard deserves the same from himself. Deeper into their walk, they make their way among some quince trees. So I'm pretty sure lots of people know what quince is, but I didn't, so in case you were in my boat, I'll tell you that quince is a type of fruit. That it kind of looks like a pear, and it's pretty tart when ripe. It's not really eaten as is, like an orange or a pear would be, but it is excellent as a jam or preserve. But anyway, Marjorie and Everard are walking among the quince trees, with Marjorie intending to pick some for herself. There was a good chance she wouldn't mind him lifting her. She had asked for help, and she kept touching him. She wasn't afraid of him, and she also didn't approach him as if he was an oddity or a conquest to boast to her friends about. She just ordered him about, which should be insulting. It was insulting, but he also liked it. He imagined ordering her about, and he liked that better. Two things here, both completely unrelated to one another. First, I did not misread, but he also liked it. That is, as it is in the text. I had, like, just jeepers criminy on toast, Harlequin. Could you be any more lazy about the books you put out? Second is the curious statement of ordering people about. Everard liked it when Marjorie tells him what to do, but he would likely prefer ordering her about. It's the language itself that raises my eyebrows. In something like a BDSM novel, our dominant might use different language. Command, for example. Or would wish that they could see their crush or love interest in a position of submission. But ordering about has some connotations. I am willing to admit that this might completely be a difference of culture. Yes, both the author and myself speak English. However, I speak American English, and that comes with its own quirks and features. The author speaks British English, and they have a different cadence, as well as a difference of vernacular. I can clearly hear ordering about in my head with a proper British accent. I've watched enough Doctor Who to be able to translate, as it were. But the implications given to us by ordering about has less to do with BDSM and more to do with patriarchal possession of a woman. We've been here before. Harlequin novels playing at being BDSM curious without any of the language associated with the lifestyle. The problem being, of course, getting all that domination without the safety net of the BDSM philosophy of safe, sane, and consensual. I am not saying that we need to break out a BDSM contract whenever we want to dip our toes into the dominant submission pool, but bringing the hints of that dynamic into a scenario where a woman was literally bought, sold, or traded without the usual safeguards is perhaps in bad taste. After an on-the-nose discussion about whether or not if the forbidden fruit in the Garden of Eden was quince, Everard gets frustrated with himself and goes off to pick as much quince as he can for Marjorie so that they can be done quicker. Except this poor chap is colorblind, so when he returns, he hands her a basket of varying degrees of ripe fruit. And because they might not have understood colorblindness the way we do today, it takes Marjorie a minute to understand what had happened with the unripe bounty Everard placed before her. This, however, is probably a roundabout way to introduce some steamy forbidden touch between our breeding pair. Marjorie attempts to associate color with temperature or sensation, blue for cold, red for hot, and so on. It goes slightly well. She gets ice, an extreme luxury just to effectively throw it away, and uses it to show blue. But she tries to throw him red with heat, and she accidentally burns him. Finally, she uses lavender to give him a smell for the color of her eyes. Eventually, they get around to touching each other some more, which leads to the inevitable. I don't think I've ever used the term bodice ripper on this podcast. I've been vaguely aware of the phrase since I was silly enough to think that sneaking harlequins into my book bag was scandalous. As I understand it, it describes a certain sort of historical romance of powerful, overbearing men in power literally ripping the clothes off their lady loves. I don't think we've actually encountered such a concept until now, because Everard is just so gosh darn impatient. He rips the clothing off of Marjorie so that he may have his way with her as he pleases. But he does get her consent for this, so that's nice. There's interesting word choices at play here. First, it's the unusual use of the word cock, at least for Harlequin. And then, instead of ass, Marjorie's rear end is referred to as fascinating globes. But cock is fine. Ass is too far? In another rare moment for this breed of romance novel, we get an ever so slight discussion about size, specifically where Everard is endowed. He's concerned that he'll hurt her, a theme throughout the entire book, and Marjorie doesn't care. We've seen a few of these before, but I don't really think I talk about it on the podcast, mostly because I don't care. Or rather, I'd prefer it wasn't mentioned, as I don't really find it helpful. For my part, I feel that it can open a discussion about the line between erotica and porn. Where does erotic fantasy end and explicit porn begin? When I was in college, this series of books came out called Porn for Women. They featured handsome, hunky men, the kind that you might see on a fireman calendar, captioned with phrases like, "Don't worry about the dishes, honey. You watch your favorite show while I wash up." The idea that drivel like this was, quote, sexy for women to the point that we would call it pornography, and that was utterly stupid. The webcomic XKCD had a fantastic response to these books, with a woman writing a letter to the publishers of Porn for Women. She states, rather bluntly, that this isn't porn, because in her porn, people fuck. But there is something to be said about what we expect in our partners. Porn for Women was popular because, at least in mainstream publishers, women couldn't expect their partners to step up with basic household needs. When we look at porn, we look at exaggerated expectations. Real women don't have G-cup boobs and then a Barbie-thin waist. Men don't look completely jacked or typically come with 9-inch dicks. These are outliers, not the norm, but the consumption of porn in high volumes runs the risk of making the outliers a baseline for partner expectations. Erotic romance toes that line between erotic and pornography, and Harlequin usually leans on the chaste end of that spectrum. The fantasy here is finding that perfect partner who loves and respects you for who you are. Well, in theory, books like His Majesty's Forbidden Temptation, where the lead male practically hates everything about the heroine, are bad and should feel bad for being bad. Talking about penis size in Harlequin novels feels strange because, in my opinion, that's not why we're here. If we wanted a book about a woman getting railed by 9-inch dicks, we'd go and get American Queen. That is porn, no question about it. I will say the talk about penis size in American Queen was not my favorite part of the story. Personally, it brought me out, especially when it got into the double penetration scene at the end of the novel. It just sounds painful, to be perfectly honest. And it's hard to get lost in the narration when the entire time I'm thinking, God, how much pain is she in right now? But hey, different strokes for different folks, as they say. If you want to read a story about an overly endowed man possibly hurting his lady friend with overly endowedness in a situation of dubious consent, be my guest. Yes, let us all remember that Marjorie is technically a prisoner, and Everard is meant to be her warden. Anyway, moving on from that tirade, Our couple has some mind-blowing sex, even though I can't see if Everard gave her any stimulation other than just shoving his dick inside her. They finish up right as Ian Warstone has returned home. Uh-oh. They scramble in order to make it look like they hadn't just been sleeping together, but Everard isn't sure if it worked. Ian doesn't let on if he knows, and instead orders Everard on a mission to meet up with a messenger in order to acquire something. But Ian isn't going with him. He will be on his own for this mission, far from Marjorie. A couple of weeks pass, and Marjorie is pretty much beside herself with worry. Worry that Ian will figure out what had happened between her and Everard. Worry about her family, and worry about Everard, of course. But Ian shows no signs of knowing, or more likely caring, that his de facto mistress had knocked boots with his personal guard, even if they don't sleep together. For now, things were calm. I wanted more of this time, to see the two of them apart, to feel the tension build as the days rolled on, but no. The narration brings Everard home sooner than later, and Marjorie is ecstatic. Her excitement doesn't last long, however, when they get down into the nitty-gritty of their conversation. Everard has too much at stake to continue doing what he's doing. His family's life was at risk, and now he cared about Marjorie enough to keep her safe. And keeping her safe meant not pursuing her. Marjorie throws him out of the room, and then a scene change brings us to a conversation between Ian and Marjorie as he writes at his desk. This scene is useful to remind us that Ian is insane. Not in a chasing delusions kind of insane, but he will kill you if he decides he doesn't like the color of your dress kind of insane. Marjorie is so very careful to speak around him, as any little thing she says might become her death sentence. She's also trying to figure out what he wants with her. He's not taking her to bed as his mistress, and she doesn't really have any information to give him, let alone tell anyone to damn him with. He talks in riddles or these half-sentences that have no meaning. I think I can see what the author is doing here, trying to deepen the danger and the mad genius that is Ian of Warstone, but to me it's just frustrating. Ian escorts her to dinner, and Everard comes up with them. During dinner, Ian is displeased by the ale, and he summons the cook. Imagine Marjorie's horror when it's not the cook that she's known and seen before, but her sister. Now, her sister's name is completely unpronounceable for me. I can't do it, and I'm not going to try. So I'm calling her sister Betty. Ian is getting more and more pissed off at Betty's behavior, so Marjorie accidentally cuts her finger with a knife to get Ian's attention off of her. It works, but Ian decides that in order to help ease the pain of her finger, he slices his knife across her palm. See? All better. The next day, Everard is seething at what had happened. Ian had surprised him by having dinner in the Great Hall, instead of his chambers, and he'd paraded around Marjorie while he did it. But who was he showing off to? The only new people in the fortress are Betty the cook and the new usher, a guy with another weird name that I'm going to call Lewis. The thing for fans of the Legends to Lovers series will know them as the couple from The Maiden and the Mercenary. I'm probably not going to read it. Sorry. But if you really want me to, drop me a line. Anyway, Everard knows that there's something about these two newcomers, because they have Ian's attention, and having Ian's attention is never good. Ian's parents and brother have also arrived for a visit, and this is also never good, because Ian hates his brother, and his parents are apparently proof that the quince doesn't fall far from the tree. He has to stand there and listen as Ian and his mother talk about him like he's furniture, something to be bought or traded and possessed, another theme, I suppose. Finally, Ian gives Everard leave, and he stalks off, trying to look like he is not running straight towards Marjorie, even though that is exactly what he's doing. The conversation between them here is part apology, part explanation. And I still hate myself for this, but my eyes are just sliding over the words without taking them in. On occasion, I'll have trouble with books like this, but not to this extent. I am forcing myself to finish this book, and I fear that it will be reflected in the final score. Marjorie reveals that Betty is her sister, begs Everard to protect her as best he can, and he promises. It looks as though they're going to try to help Marjorie make a break for it, but I can't be sure. Again, my brain is that perfect slip and slide to forget everything. Later on, as Marjorie is pacing like an agitated lion, Betty is able to see her under the pretense of bringing her food, since she is supposed to be the cook after all. She's brought Lewis with her, since he's an usher, of course. But he drops his pretense as soon as the door is shut and immediately goes to rifle through Ian's things. Now, I'm not really interested, again, in reading that book about Betty and Lewis, but I am a little curious to see how this scene plays out in the original story. This is supposedly where the author got that frustrating plot bunny that led to this book. There's a lot that happens in the conversation. Bickering between sisters, for one getting into danger for the other, Marjorie not trusting Lewis as far as she could throw him, and something about poisoned ale. There's a lot of context that I'm not getting here, because it's clear that there is more going on behind the scenes. Occasionally, I'll read the blurbs for other books in a series to get some of that context if I need it, but from the looks of things, a majority of the books in the Legends to Lovers series don't really seem to have anything to do with one another, at least from my outsider perspective. But three seem to be linked: Betty and Lewis's story, the one that we are currently reading, and one that features Ian's brother, Balthius. That alone tells me that not all Warstones are terrible, but there's a lot happening, and I'm sort of stuck trying to put a puzzle together without all of the pieces. The time for conversation is running out for the three of them, as the Warstones are returning from a ride or a hunt, I'm not sure, and Betty insults Everard. That'll get Marjorie's hackles up, and she defends him. She explains that she'd fallen in love, and for some reason, Ian's turned a blind eye. That's when Lewis says, no, he didn't. In fact, Ian liked to watch as Marjorie and Everard did the horizontal tango. I'd be baffled as to why Lewis knew that, but I am too busy trying not to vomit everywhere. But the implications are far worse. If Ian saw them knocking boots, then he must also know that Marjorie told Everard about Betty being her sister. The danger has exploded at this point, but getting out of the fortress will be next to impossible. Unable to do anything else, Betty and Lewis have no choice but to leave Marjorie in Ian's quarters. Hours later, Marjorie hadn't seen hide nor hair of Ian, Everard, or anyone else familiar. Just as she's about to go mad with the stress, Everard returns, and with him the news that Ian is dead. So that's it. Our biggest threat, the greatest obstacle in the way of our couple's safety, has had the poor manners to go and die off-screen? Really? I realize that there were two other books before this one. Things have happened off-screen. But this genuinely sucks. Was there no other perspective that we could have watched as Ian bit the big one? You can't set up this increasingly crazy bad guy just to get rid of him easy as pie. And before y'all come at me saying, oh, but you'd know what happened if you read the other books, I would like to direct you to that author's note at the beginning of the book, where she explicitly stated that I didn't have to read any of them. I could have picked this up and as an independent story and not looked at any of the others. So I have been robbed of a final showdown, and I'm going to be as salty as I want about it. I will also say that I didn't pick up on Ian's death the first time that I read this novel. Like I said, my eyes are just sliding over the words, and his death was just tossed away. And Marjorie and Everard spend so much time fighting each other that I don't take in their full conversations. And I really, really need you to know that as Everard is explaining what happened, there is a random number, 258 to be precise, just dropped into the text. No, it's not related to anything, just there. I've said this before, I am not going to fully blame the author for mistakes in the printing. I fully hold the publisher responsible. Harlequin, I am officially sick and tired of this. Fucking shape up, because your readers deserve better. Anyway, apparently a steward had been poisoning the ale, which Ian figured out, forced the steward to drink it, and killed him. Soon after, Ian tried to kill Balthus, because, again, crazy. Lewis killed Ian. And Everard was witness to everything in order to protect Betty. We couldn't have watched as Everard was doing this. We couldn't have seen Ian's death from Everard's perspective. We have to watch him tell... Sorry. So the showdown was told to us by a guy explaining that he's horrible, a monster, for having done things Ian told him to do. Everard's got this complex that he's this big hulking brute of a monster. That's why Ian liked him, because of his size. And Marjorie won't hear of it. That's been a lot of their fights, and it was such a joy to read them. Marjorie insists that she doesn't care, that he did what he had to do to survive. They spend the night together, but when Marjorie wakes up the next morning, Everard isn't there. Jean is, though. She brought Marjorie some breakfast, as well as the news that not only had Ian ordered the steward to drink the ale, but also the cook and the new usher. This prompts Marjorie to run to the kitchens to find Betty perfectly fine. Her ale had not been poisoned, thankfully. Oh, and Lewis was fine too, but who cares? This would be the conversation in Betty's story, where we would see the family member or the friend help the heroine figure out what the hell has been going on in her love life. Interesting to see it from this side, but we aren't here for them. We are here for Marjorie and Everard. The sisters don't part on great terms. They do eventually make up, but Marjorie is left to wonder what else to do with herself now that she's free. There's a lot of changes happening at the fortress, none of them really concerning us, because Everard's loyalty to Ian ended the moment the man died. So when he catches up to Marjorie, she asks him to take her to his village. On the way, they talk, eat mulberries, and have sex, as you do. When they arrive at the village, Marjorie feels out of place, as Everard sinks right back into his home as though he'd never left. She fears that people would see a well-dressed woman being led on a horse by her servant, but Everard feels differently. But now he was free, and at his side was a woman whom he adored, whom he intended to spend the rest of his life with. He's shown her that honor by dismounting and pulling her through the village rather than simply going around to the far side where his family lived. He'd wanted to introduce her to everyone, and he had, pleased that he had refrained from marking her neck or other places that they could see. Everard is clearly proud of her, but it would be nice if he told her that with his words, you know? Out of the blue, when they finally make it to his house, Marjorie starts to panic when she sees that Everard's upbringing had been quite a bit nicer than hers. She'd sold herself for her family. Everard had no need to do so until Ian showed up, so she hadn't realized that they'd likely wanted for nothing the way her family had. Our story is already done, essentially. It should have ended with Ian's death and perhaps a brief description of their declarations of love, so I don't know why we're getting this added moment of tension here. I swear, if they throw in a third act separation, I'm quitting. The situation isn't helped when Everard's teenage sister acts like a spoiled teenage brat when Marjorie arrives, so there's another road bump. This sister is quite awful, to be honest. Marjorie had always felt a burden on her family, so when she tries to help her around or get clothes more suited to life on a village farm, the sister throws a fit. Marjorie decides to take her fancy dress and shoes and find Everard in the fields anyway. When she reaches them, she unloads how much of a terrible person she is, how she burdened her family, how she sold her body to survive, how much she didn't deserve to be here with him. And the man who's basically been a brick wall this whole book uses his words at last to tell her how wrong she is. He declares his love for her, in time for his mother and sister to hear, and she accepts his declaration. At last, they are at peace, looking forward towards the future. And that's her honorable mercenary. Okay, perhaps I'll explain how I feel about it. No, there's too much, so I'll sum up with Heather's final score. The cover will get a 2 out of 5. Really, it's fine. I planned on being merciful because it's not that bad. But as I read further into this book, Harlequin's laziness in general erased any goodwill that I had. That's it. That's the whole reason. Drama gets a 3 out of 5. I could feel the tension build as Marjorie tried to navigate the fortress, knowing that any perceived slight would mean her death. It's compounded when her sister arrives and I'm expecting a huge fight incoming. But we're given so much dramatic setup that I feel extremely dissatisfied when I didn't get any payoff whatsoever. Ian dies off-screen, problems are solved away from our couple, and the made-up drama at the end did not make up for it. Romance is a 2 out of 5. I just didn't feel it between our couple. If they weren't arguing about something, they were just sort of fumbling their way through their connection. Yes, they had to be guarded because of the circumstances, but their relationship did absolutely nothing for me. And when they fought, it felt like the same argument over and over again. The only reason it's not a flat 1 here is because Everard finally figured out how to use his words like a big boy. Good job, Everard. Spice is a 2 out of 5. I don't have much to say about it other than it's typical for hotter Harlequins, which is to say, just barely sexy. Realism will get a 3 out of 5. Again, I'm no historian, but a woman traded as commodity, warlords, families fighting each other, it's all absolutely par for the course for medieval Europe. Everything else is a who the hell knows moment for me. But at the end of it all, the thing that rings through this whole book is just laziness. I don't feel as though the author was invested in this story as she claimed. It feels like something that she had to get out of the way in order to get to her next work, either by her own choice or she was compelled by the publisher or her readers. It just didn't feel like something she cared about. Even aside from the author was Harlequin's laziness, from the grammar to poor editing choices to random ass numbers just jumping out of nowhere. It was frustrating, to say the least. I'm tired, Harlequin. I'm not keen on getting anything else from your library if this is going to be how it is. Which sucks, because if it weren't for Harlequin, I wouldn't be sitting here, doing this. Authors deserve better, readers deserve better, and I deserve better. And finally, this episode is late, later than promised, twice. Yes, there were some outside influences, but one reason I couldn't get this episode out was because this novel was just so difficult to read. I don't know if it was the printing, the construction of the narration, but I have never had such a hard time reading a book. And I have read some really, really bad books. However, it's not a complete trash fire, because like I said, I've read some stinkers. So for my final score, Her Honorable Mercenary will get 2 confusing plot lines out of 5. Thank you for joining me, readers and romance seekers, and I hope to see you once again for Hopelessly Romantic. If you like the show, please visit us at hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. If you have questions or want to recommend a read, please email us at contact@hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. The show is written and produced by me, Heather Songster. Our technical advisor is Kwang Hin Cho. Hopelessly Romantic is an Age with K production. And it doesn't matter what you read, only that it's what you love.